This is Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, a performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblom. The Iowa Arts Showcase delves this month into unique cultural opportunities across the state. We'll drop by the University of Dubuque to take a peek at their new amazing Heritage Center. We'll stop by the Putnam Museum in Davenport to see what all the fuss is about for their Diana a Celebration exhibition. We'll hear how one of Iowa's own creative movers and shakers is having a new work premiered this month at the Kennedy Center. And we'll learn how one Iowa community is paying special tribute through the arts to the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
This has been a long-time dream for us, which began really in the late 1990s, which was an implausible dream. And that it has happened is really a culmination of a lot of work and vision and philanthropy. And we're sincerely grateful to our supporters, to our alums, to our community for helping to make this happen. This will mature and change the University of Dubuque in ways we can't even pretend to understand, but we do know that it'll all be good. So we're thankful to be at this place, and we're thankful to be able to share it with our community and with our state.
I think of this building as being kind of an incubator for the arts. You know, I hope that we'll be a catalyst for the arts, you know, not just on this campus, but in the community eventually. As we grow, I see the community becoming more involved with the building and being more collaborative with the campus in terms of what's happening with the arts. You know, the Dubuque Symphony has its roots here at the University of Dubuque. There's also the Dubuque Chorale. They started at the University of Dubuque. This is sort of a renaissance for the arts occurring with this building. I hope that we'll be a catalyst. I hope that students who are getting lots of hands-on experience in the arts, I hope this is a place where, you know, eventually they'll be able to look back and say, you know, that's where I got my start, that we offered the opportunities that inspired them. Maybe not to have a career in the arts, but at least to have maybe an avocation, maybe have a hobby. So if we can be a catalyst and the laboratory aspect of the facility can be successful, you know, several years down the road, I think we'll be able to look back and say, you know, we really made a difference, we made an impact. That's some of my hopes and dreams for the facility.
Dr. Jeffrey Bullock, president of the University of Dubuque, and Thomas Robbins, executive director of the University of Dubuque's Heritage Center. Both very passionate and excited about describing and sharing their incredible new state-of-the-art Performing Arts Worship and Campus Center. After an international search for an architect, the University of Dubuque's quest ended in their own backyard with architects who had already been working on campus for over 10 years. Committee members knew in an instant when they saw the Straka Johnson Architects concept of the Heritage Center that their vision was perfect. President Bullock goes on to say that his early background didn't have many opportunities in the arts.
Unfortunately, I have very little artistic ability in terms of fine arts, but I have a love and a fondness for them, and I think maybe that gives me a little better point of view because, you know, I grew up without that, and in my adult life realize how important the arts are, not only just to kind of rounding out us as human beings, but the arts really do transform people, relationships and communities in very important and profound ways, and they're worth investing in a myriad of ways, and we're happy to be able to contribute to that.
One of the emphasis here at the University of Dubuque was that you integrated your student life with this arts center. Tell us about that.
Right, that theme is called Arts and Worship by Osmosis, and part of what we're trying to do is a little autobiographical. I grew up in a community that we had one stoplight in our county. So the thought of taking part in a play, for example, never would have entered my mind. I was a woodshop kid, so had I known that I could have taken part in building sets or helping with scene construction, I would have done that in a heartbeat. So as you walk through this building, what you'll see are kind of purposeful intersections between everyday life and art. And I think one of the critiques I have of the art world today is it's also segregated, and you cannot continue to grow audiences or develop interest without kind of subtly, carefully, intentionally introducing people and exposing people to all the possibilities. You know, when we studied this, we found that there were literally over 70 different ways that students could take part in an event without ever acting or without ever singing. And when we talk about, you know, education for life and lifelong learning and commitment and investing in our communities, that's certainly one of the important ways that all of us can invest in every single community across the state, regardless of the size of the community. So we're excited, and we think, frankly, this may change the way that art facilities and performance facilities are built across America, frankly.
Tell us or describe this building and some of the really beautiful architectural design that you've added.
You'll see throughout this building themes that resonate with art, everything from just the flowing lines that are reminiscent of treble clefs, and some people have even seen cellos in those lines, to lots of neat movement. There's supposed to be surprise every place that you look and see and sit and eat and watch and listen. And you'll see a lot of copper, a lot of beautiful maple wood, some walnut, and it's not in the size, it's not in the volume. The beauty is in the detail. And one of the things we've really tried to do over the years as we've built lots of buildings is we want to make them comfortable buildings where the building itself invites people in. So you'll see lots of natural light. We pay a lot of attention to the way that light creates shadows and reflects off of different parts of the building. The staircases are a good example. And so the staircases themselves are a work of art. And part of the subtle message here is that art and beauty are all around us. And we don't have to be wealthy, we don't have to be from these enormously privileged backgrounds to appreciate the beauty that we've been surrounded with on a daily basis. And that's part of what we're trying to do, the message that we're trying to communicate as we walk in this building. The other subtle message, and you see this in the heritage display, and it's very important for us, for our students to understand this and our community to understand this, is that none of us got here on our own, that all of us stand on the shoulders of those who've gone before us. And so while it is very important to kind of live our lives looking forward and paying things forward, it's also very important to recognize that lots of people have made sacrifices, have made commitments that have allowed us to be at this place, and that we have a special stewardship responsibility to recognize those commitments, value them, and then pay them forward as we all have the opportunity to contribute to the larger world. So in a very real way, this building sings, and I'm looking forward to even experiencing it more as we move on.
Dr. Jeffrey Bullock, the president of the University of Dubuque, talking about the University of Dubuque's newly opened Heritage Center, which was officially dedicated on October 13th of this year and is situated right in the heart of the University of Dubuque's campus. The center's executive director, Thomas Robbins, goes on to talk about their inaugural performing arts series called Live at Heritage Center and the Heritage Center's main hall.
John and Alice Butler Hall is about a 1,000-seat venue. It's a multi-purpose auditorium. You know, the idea was that it wouldn't be necessarily a concert hall or a theater. We want to be able to present everything from music, dance, theater, all types of genres in those areas, as well as spoken word, comedy, you know, the whole caveat of different types of performances.
Now, tomorrow you're going to be presenting the ensemble Galilea. Tell us about some of the other groups that will be appearing here.
With this being our inaugural season, we wanted to make sure that we set our sights pretty high. We have a number of groups that are coming from international places. We have the Soweto Gospel Choir coming in March from South Africa, probably one of the top 10 gospel groups in the world. And very much like that, we have the King Singers from England, also top of their form. In February of 2014, we've got a professional theater company from New York City called Aquila Theater coming with a drama, Fahrenheit 451. We closed the season with a Japanese taiko drumming group out of San Jose, California. And then we throw in a few family performances in between. And the nice thing that we will do in conjunction with these performances is offer educational elements that intersect with some of our curriculum on campus. We will do workshops, we'll do seminars, and we'll also have opportunities for the community where we'll take artists into the schools or take them into spaces that you might not expect in order to expose people to the arts who may be, you know, not as involved. We've got to take artists into places that people wouldn't normally expect. Those are some of our plans.
Tell us then about your Black Box Theater as well.
The Babka Black Box is a much more intimate theater than John and Alice Butler Hall. It is a flexible, very versatile black box space. We can configure it in a variety of arrangements, but primarily it's a laboratory for theater. You know, classes will be taught in the black box, a variety of dance activities will be happening there. We have mirrors and bars for dance rehearsals and practices. So it will be a heavily, heavily used space and really a premier performance venue in the area. I'm not sure of a black box theater of this scope and size within a 100-mile radius.
Well, it's very versatile, too, because you have it equipped with a dance floor as well.
Yeah, actually, both of our theater spaces have a sprung dance floor. So dance is a very important part of the curriculum. It's kind of an emerging program for us. We have dance going on in the community. We hope that they will be utilizing the spaces as well.
And in addition to having these marvelous theaters, you also have a gallery space.
We do. It's the Charles and Elizabeth Bisignano Art Gallery. It's a very bright, open, completely surrounded by glass, with lots of natural light bleeding in, and it really creates kind of a value-added enhancement for people who are coming to performances to spend time in the gallery before the show, during intermission, after the show. Currently, we have alumni art on display, so it creates kind of a premier space on campus for students to display their artwork. It's a treat, and it's a luxury, you know, to be able to showcase our students and our faculty artwork in that space.
Thomas Robbins, Executive Director and Special Assistant to the President for the University of Dubuque's Heritage Center. To learn more about this remarkable new venue, their Live at the Heritage Center Performing Arts Series, and the many University of Dubuque Fine and Performing Arts Department concerts and other events and educational opportunities at the Heritage Center, please go to dbq.edu. There is a button on the main page that will take you directly to the Heritage Center. You can also order tickets there online. The University of Dubuque Farber box office is also open weekday afternoons between 12:30 and 5:30, plus 90 minutes prior to a performance. Just ahead, you'll learn what personal treasures are included in a special show running now at Davenport's Putnam Museum honoring Diana, Princess of Wales. We'll hear about a world premiere at the Kennedy Center featuring an opera composed by a Dubuque native. And we'll find out about a special collaborative program commemorating the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
Things I love best about the Putnam is on any given day, I see people here from 2 to 92 years old having a spectacular experience. And it may be that the 2-year-old is here with a preschool class, but probably they're here in a multi-generational family excursion. We have a Science Interactive in our grand lobby now that launches tennis balls up to the ceiling and you have to pull a rope and make this thing work. So one day I saw a little child who was hanging on to the end of the rope, trying to pull it down their mightiest pull, and just not too successful. And then here comes Great Grandpa in his motorized wheelchair over to assist his little great grandchild to have this experience. That makes me have goosebumps every time I see it. I don't know that in today's society we have as much intergenerational family experience, especially ones where we're actually face to face. We're not watching something else happen as much as we are doing things together. And so if you think about what you might traditionally think of when you hear the word museum, dark, dank, old, musty, dusty, things like that, where you're going to walk by things and they're under plexiglass in a case and you read about them, but you don't really get to experience them. Here at the Putnam, we're doing everything we can to make every excursion one that has life, memory building experiences in it.
The director of Davenport's Putnam Museum, Kim Finley, talking about the unique and amazing opportunities at the Putnam. This is the iWard Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallblom. The Putnam of today is based on a 145-year history that started as the Davenport Academy of Science. Currently, the Putnam boasts a 120,000-square-foot facility, including interactive hands-on exhibits with a 264-seat giant screen theater, and exhibits that meld together and rival Chicago's Field and Science and Industry Museums. Kim continues.
We, like many other folks, have gotten into exploring the world of social media. So you can certainly find out a great deal about the Putnam either at the website and take yourself into certain experiences. For example, we have Bix Beiderbecke's cornet here. And when we were trying to teach about local history, we partnered with Scott County and we did what was called the cornet caper. So you could download an app and you got different clues every day to the mystery of where had Bix's cornet disappeared to. Now next spring, the spring of 14, we will have a blockbuster exhibit here called CSI, The Experience. And this is based upon and partnered with the CBS television production, CSI. We're thinking about having some sort of interactive experience leading up to that, where people can solve mysteries. And then when you come to the exhibit, you have four, I believe they're all probably murders that have occurred, and you become the crime scene investigator. And then you pick up clues and do forensic investigation and science, the labs, and the exhibit has its own website as well. So you can go there and learn and follow along with different types of interactive, mind-bending, thought-generating experiences too.
Well, tell us about this exhibit that you currently have showing, and this is one of the last places it's going to be before it heads back home. Tell us about this amazing collection.
Well, I'm happy to tell you about Princess Diana's exhibit. This exhibit is produced by the Althorp Estate, and that's Diana's family, the Spencer family. When you say that once it leaves here, it will go back home, that's true, but it's probably even more than that. Once Prince William and Prince Harry turned 30, all of the items in the exhibit, which are all personal items and artifacts from the Spencer family and Diana herself, will belong to Harry and William, and I'm told that they will not be on exhibit, either in the UK, and certainly not again in the United States after 2014. It's very important that people come to experience it, not only because it's the last time you will ever likely be able to see Princess Diana's wedding gown, home movies taken by Princess Diana's father, diamond tiaras, a prayer book given by Mother Teresa to Princess Diana handwritten prayer from Mother Teresa, Elton John's handwritten rewording of the lyrics to Candle in the Wind. All of these very moving things that so many of us recall in our own lifetime having occurred. So yes, come, because you don't want to miss this. You'll regret it if you do. And come because entities such as the Putnam really thrive on the support of the community in the region.
Kim goes on to talk about the two men who assembled the Diana Celebration Exhibition and describes the unique care used to transport it.
Princess Diana's wedding gown travels in its own humidity and temperature controlled crating. And when they did the unveiling, the reveal of the wedding dress, that certainly is the pinnacle of installing the exhibition. Nick and Graham, two very nice gentlemen, were in fact asked by Princess Diana's brother, Charles Spencer, to go through the family's items, attics. Nick and Graham hand selected every piece of clothing and most of the artifacts, personal items of Diana's that are displayed in this exhibit. The wedding gown, they are the exclusive people to handle it. They've told me a few things about it that I didn't know, such as the entire piece, including the 25-foot train, weighs less than 3.5 pounds. There was a little golden horseshoe sewn onto the wedding gown, along with all of the seed pearls and the beautiful glistening parts of the dress, for luck. On Princess Diana's wedding shoes, which are on display here, the soles are painted with gold in little beautiful designs. And on the inside of one heel, when you come to see the exhibit, get down to eye level with that, and you will see in gold, C, heart, the symbol for heart, D. So many little personal touches and things that they were able to share with us when they were here.
And another thing about this exhibit is that it goes sort of through her entire life from the very beginning and into some of the major work she did at the end, which is so important.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, it's not, I think, chauvinistic to believe that the majority of people coming to this exhibit are going to be ladies. And while that is true, we have found that the gentlemen who do come to the exhibit and go through with their wives and daughters come out the other side and say, well, I just came because she really wanted me to, but I was very fascinated with this. There's a tremendous amount of history. There's so many things that I actually remember myself. And quite honestly, it's very moving. And the last gallery in the exhibit is the condolence gallery. So it is about the time after the accident and Diana's death, where I mentioned Juicy Elton John's handwritten change to the words. You also have a video, large video screen, almost a movie screen, showing the funeral procession and aspects of the funeral. Do you know, 2.5 billion people worldwide viewed the funeral. 1 billion people viewed the wedding.
She did have a major impact on some things that we're still feeling the repercussions of today in a positive way.
Yes, my favorite ensemble in Diana Gallery of all of her beautiful pieces of clothing from the early days when she and Charles were engaged up until the very last gown she ever wore in public before her death. My favorite is a pair of khaki slacks, a denim shirt, a flak vest, and a face shield. And when you see it, you will remember seeing photos of Diana in war-torn areas where she was putting herself in harm's way to bring attention to the devastating situation of landmines being left behind in these areas and children and families having limbs torn off by landmines that they did not realize were there. And I think that today we're a little bit more accustomed to seeing people like George Clooney and Angelina Jolie going out and using their fame, their celebrity, to bring attention to atrocities around the world. But Diana really was among the first to do that on a large scale level, global attention to the AIDS epidemic, which think about when she was most famous and how pervasive the AIDS problem was at that time, and leprosy. She went to a hospital and touched people who had leprosy. So when we say that Diana was the people's princess, some people think that that means that she came from a family of quote commoners. That's a misperception. Diana's family goes back hundreds of years, and this is also an aspect of the exhibit, is her lineage. And jewels from the ladies of the Spencer family dating back several hundred years as well. It's not that she was a commoner, it's that she loved people of all walks of life, and they returned that love to her because she had empathy and compassion.
The director of Davenport's Putnam Museum, Kim Finley. For more details about the Putnam Museum and their show, Diana, A Celebration, please visit putnam.org. Plus, you can also like the Putnam on Facebook. The Diana, A Celebration exhibition continues now through January 5th of 2014. Starting at the Putnam on November 8th, will be a 3D presentation on the giant screen of the film Jerusalem. The film will also have a special opening on November 7th with a guest appearance by film writer, director, and producer Daniel Ferguson at 5:30 and 7:30 p.m. More details are available at putnam.org. Don't go away. We'll learn details about the Washington National Opera's American Opera Initiative, and we'll hear about an amazing collaboration involving musicians and actors commemorating the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht. That's all ahead. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about how opera has changed over the centuries. When I was at Columbia, I took this seminar. It was actually an anthropology seminar on Mozart operas and how Mozart's work really reflected what was going on in his world at that time, the social change, the upheaval, the good and the bad. And his operas were fairly revolutionary in that sense. And I think in our world, we tend to forget how important the messages of social change are in these great pieces of music. And I think that's something that for a lot of young writers, that's something that's important for us to sort of bring back into our world and to reintroduce in a way that is really relevant to what is going on in our world today. And that's certainly something that we've tried to do in Breaking.
Iowa's own composer, Michael Gilbertson. Michael and librettist Carolyn McGraw were selected this spring for a commission by the Washington National Opera's American Opera Initiative, along with two other hand-picked writer-composer teams of great promise. Each team was asked to compose a new 20-minute opera which will be premiered in a chamber orchestra concert performance at the Kennedy Center on November 13th. Michael and Carolyn's new opera is called Breaking. Michael continues.
I grew up in Dubuque, Iowa, and studied music here through high school. And I moved out to the East Coast when I went to college. I went to Juilliard in Columbia for 4 years and lived in New York for 5 years, and then moved to Yale, where I've studied for the last 2 years. I studied composition at the Yale School of Music. And my career as a composer has been my primary focus, and I've been traveling around the country a great deal the last few years with that. And that's brought me to writing lots of orchestral music, chamber music, and now for the first time, opera and a lot of ballets as well.
So tell us about some of the awards that you have received.
In the past few years, I've received awards mainly for my compositions. I've gotten a few ASCAP Morton Gould Awards, and for the first time this past year, I got a BMI Student Composer Award, which is one of the most difficult awards for a young composer to receive. These are awards that are judged by composers in their mid to very mature careers. So it's a sign that other people in the field really respect your work and see a great deal of potential in it. So that's meant a great deal to me over the years. One of the other prizes I got was a Charles Ives Scholarship from the American Academy of Arts and Letters back in, I think, 2009. And that award in particular meant a great deal to me to have the members of the Academy really recognizing my work. That meant a great, great deal to me.
And give us a few of the names of some of the amazing composers you've studied with.
Well, I've had an unbelievable list of teachers. I've been so lucky. I studied with a couple Pulitzer Prize winners, John Corigliano, Christopher Rouse, Aaron J. Kernis. I also studied with Sam Adler at Yale, who's one of the great composition pedagogues of the United States. And at Yale, I've also studied with Martin Bresnik, who's the chair of the composition department there, and Ezra Latterman and Christopher Theofanides.
How did you decide I've got to compose?
I don't think I ever decided. I just kind of started doing it. And I wasn't totally aware of what I was doing at first. You know, I was studying piano when I was 12, 13, 14 years old here in Dubuque. And my first piano teacher here, her name was Patricia Giegrich, and she was a great, great teacher and so encouraging to me. And she encouraged me to be very creative with what I was doing, and I started just sort of improvising at the piano. And she started working with me a little bit on that and started encouraging me to explore that more. And as I kept, you know, improvising, I, you know, was really starting to compose. And by the time I was about 14, I started taking lessons here at the Northeast Iowa School of Music in composition with Tracy Rush. And Tracy was also very encouraging to me and was one of the people who realized, you know, you're really already a composer and you should really, not very many people have this gift that you can, you know, just sit down and start writing. There's not a lot of people that comes to and you should really explore that. So I just kept doing it and that's kind of just continued to where I am now.
Well, let's talk about this magnificent opportunity that is coming your way. And how did this all evolve? How did it happen?
Last year, I studied at Yale with Janine Tesori, who is one of the leading Broadway composers today. She worked on Thoroughly Modern Millie and wrote Carolina Change with Tony Kushner. And Janine was really encouraging to me and had a very close connection with the Washington National Opera. And through my connection with Janine, she helped me apply for this commission. They have a program at the Washington National Opera called the American Opera Initiative. And every year they commission a few short operas from pairs of young composers and librettists or playwrights, writers. And I decided to work with a writer named Caroline McGraw, who I knew from Yale. She's a great, great playwright, and I was really impressed with her work when I saw it at Yale. She has a wonderful lyrical voice, and back when I was working in a musical theater seminar at Yale, Caroline worked with me on some lyrics, and I found that we had a really great rapport with each other, and I found her words to set to music very, very easily. So I thought she'd be a great collaborator for this project. And so Caroline and I applied together and we got the commission. And for the past few months, we've been working together on an opera called Breaking. And the opera is about a young reporter named Joanna, who has been really sort of suppressed by her superiors. And she's just been working on some very boring stories, very simple human interest local stories. And she really wants to break out of this and do some sort of hard-hitting news to try to get ahead. She's very ambitious. And she gets her first big break. which is a hostage situation in the town she lives in. And as she's reporting on this story, she sort of loses sight of how dangerous the situation has become and ends up being very insensitive in the way she's reporting on the air, and people end up getting killed. And so it's a tragic opera that sort of exposes and kind of explores the dark side of our 24-hour news cycle. And, you know, in our world, the line between what is news and what is entertainment has become blurred and has become sort of dangerous in the way that we view it and consume it. And so this opera explores that.
Michael and Carolyn's opera, Breaking, will be performed by promising young top-notch singers who are participating in the Washington National Opera's Young Artist Program. This opportunity also came with a chance to work with big names in the opera world.
We actually had sort of several mentors working with us who the Washington National Opera bring in as kind of like editors, as they go over our work and give us recommendations and ideas to try out. And, you know, the thing about working in opera is that you are not autonomous at all. You are working with a very large web of people, of designers, a director, artistic director of the company, whoever's running the vocal coachings, an orchestral conductor, not to mention these additional sort of guides that they bring in to help us and coach us. So you're working with a tremendously large web of people. So that can be challenging at times, but it's also very beneficial to have many sets of ears and eyes to give you reactions and ideas about how the work is coming across. Some of the people we had included the composer Jake Hagee, who's a very famous American opera composer. His works have been done by the San Francisco Opera, the Washington National Opera. I know they've been workshopped at the Metropolitan Opera, the City Opera. So he was a really great source of guidance for us. We also had the American conductor Ann Manson with us, who was giving us a lot of ideas about sort of the trajectory of the music and where things were going. And we also had a librettist named Mark Campbell, whose libretto for Silent Night last year won the Pulitzer Prize for music, which was an opera written with Kevin Putz for, I think, the Minnesota Opera. So they were all very valuable to us and just amazing people to have advising us on the project.
How does it feel to be in the midst of these folks?
At times it's a little crippling. It really is. You know, as a composer, and I think Caroline as well as a writer, is really used to working in very solitary conditions and having a lot of time to think and sort of reflect on what we're doing. And with a project like this, which has gone by very quickly, and when we're constantly getting feedback and ideas from people, it's very challenging for us to sort of regroup and decide where to keep going with the piece. It's been very difficult, actually. It's a very different way of working from just being a composer like I usually am. And it's actually very different from working in musical theater, where you really start from a different place. You start more from a sort of dramatic perspective. And opera has a very different kind of process, in part because of the way opera companies are run, in part because of how long it takes to write them. So it's a very, you know, just adapting to the process is a big part of writing an opera, and I think was a big challenge for both of us.
So when you were growing up in Dubuque, Iowa, did you think that one day you would be writing an opera for the Kennedy Center?
I don't know if I knew what the Kennedy Center really was until I was, you know, in my 20s. But I always was interested in writing dramatic work, and I've always really enjoyed doing collaborative work. That's one of the reasons I've done so many ballets and I've worked with writers like Caroline, is because I just really enjoy working in a collaborative setting, whether it's working with a poet or a choreographer. I find that the level of my work gets much, much higher when I have another artist with whom I can bounce ideas off of and whose sort of artistic energy I can draw from as well. So on that level, it's something I've always wanted to do and always wanted to explore, but I'm not sure I ever pictured the Kennedy Center.
Michael Gilbertson, composer and Iowa native. We all send Michael and his librettist, Carolyn McGraw, best wishes for their exciting premiere at the Kennedy Center. Michael returns every year to Iowa for his Juilliard and June Festival that he hosts in Dubuque in conjunction with the Northeast Iowa School of Music. Across the state, there are several chances to hear Michael's music. The Dubuque Symphony is presenting a premiere of Michael's holiday piece for orchestra and solo soprano on their Pops concert this December. Orchestra Iowa is presenting Michael's Fold by Fold work on their January chamber concert. And the Red Cedar Chamber has commissioned Michael to compose a new work for them that they will be premiering this spring. To find out more details on Michael and his career, you can go to his website at michaelgilbertson.net. Just ahead, the stage is being set for a collaborative performance incorporating musicians and actors to commemorate Kristallnacht. You're listening to the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
This isn't a dirge. This is actually got lively elements to it, and it's a living form. And so I think people are going to find themselves not disappointed or depressed by it, which one would easily think, you know, Kristallnacht, a hard subject. But I think it actually has an uplifting element, and I suspect the audience is going to walk out feeling stronger, knowing more, understanding more. And that's really what we all want our performances to accomplish, because it really is about a human experience. It really is about conflict and adversity. And I think you're going to find some distinct tones that are that cross boundaries.
I mean, as someone whose work is to promote Holocaust awareness and to foster efforts at Holocaust education, it's really great to see people from other disciplines coming together to do just that. But I have to say that I'm not really surprised, because for the last several years, the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education has had tremendous cooperation from the symphony. Faculty from the School of Music, from Cedar Valley Chamber Music, have performed at our annual Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony. So it's really the continuation of a very, very powerful contribution to this whole effort. And I think this is going to be a very, very special event. To a large extent, it's who we are. And that's why I think the event is going to be the kind of event that it will be.
It has been a really incredibly rewarding thing to be involved with. This is something I think it's really worth thinking about in the contemporary world. But, you know, at times, if you just get on stage and you kind of lecture to people, the message can seem like it's not, you know, it doesn't affect me, or it doesn't move me, or that's just someone talking. Or I read about this in a book or a magazine, but it just doesn't have a direct impact. And so that idea of using art as a means for exploring the issues that have come out of this event, and that gives us an opportunity to reach people in a different way, and maybe also to impact people in a different way. And I think that's one of the things that makes this so rewarding for me. You know, and of course, it's such a pleasure to collaborate with this entire group of people, and that in itself is one of the perks of the job.
Dr. Steve Kerrigan, UNI's Associate Dean of Special Programs, and the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center's Executive Director. Dr. Stephen Gaze, UNI's Professor of Language and Literature and Director of the UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education. And Jason Weinberger, CEO and Music Director of the WCF Symphony. You're listening to the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Steve, Stephen, and Jason join forces with a whole host of community leaders in the Cedar Valley to collaborate on a special program using the arts to commemorate the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht. Stephen Gaze continues.
Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass, was a watershed event in what we now call the Holocaust, because it involved the first large-scale, organized, state-sponsored violence against one of the groups that Nazi Germany was persecuting, namely the Jews of Germany and Austria and parts of Czechoslovakia. So after 5.5 years of laws and propaganda, harassment, intimidation, appeals to ordinary German self-interest as ways of isolating German Jews from mainstream society and encouraging them to emigrate, the stakes were raised by bringing violence in the form of arson, plunder, looting, large-scale arrests. This was the first time that Jews were sent to concentration camps, which had been built for political prisoners. And I would say that this concert, like the event that it commemorates, is really a call to action, an appeal to the world's conscience, because this was an event not just about the people who were targeted by Nazi Germany, but about all of us. Because so much of Kristallnacht is the story of what the world did and didn't do in the months leading up to Kristallnacht and what happened in the wake of this pogrom. And many of the issues that were in play in 1938 and 1939 are the issues that we wrestle with today whenever there's a humanitarian crisis someplace in the world.
And Jason, now you are going to help craft and approach this whole topic from the artistic side. Tell us about how this is all going to come together.
This particular event in specific is sort of special for me in the sense that all of my grandparents are Holocaust survivors. And this is a story that I grew up with and has very much informed my own life and my own artistic career. So to be able to have an opportunity to participate in the presentation of an event like this is not only artistically, you know, important and feels very momentous to me, but personally, there's also quite a large element to this. We've all been brought in, and yet at the same time, we do all have different experiences. And I think in a way, our team that has worked on the event is a wonderful model for what really happens when we present the event to the public, when people come to it from many different perspectives and try and share in some of the ideas and the emotions and thoughts that have emerged from it. So really quite a singular experience to be involved in this project. And I'm thrilled to, you know, be on stage performing. I think some of the works we've chosen are really amazing, but also have been very gratified to be part of the team planning and preparing this event.
Steve Kerrigan talks about working together on this project.
And that's why it needed so much collaboration, is because there are multiple stories and multiple perspectives. Sometimes a first-person perspective as a story is told by a UNI theater student who's developed a piece, a spoken word piece from that original source material. Sometimes it's a child's perspective, and I think that's one of the exciting things about Paula's piece. It was a sort of a meditation, again, a piece that was written from a very distinct perspective, looking at the experience of children who went through that Holocaust experience, went through the Kristallnacht experience. And so you really get to look at it from a lot of different perspectives. And I think that's really important. You know, when you have a complicated issue, genocide is not a simple thing. When you have a complicated issue, you need multiple perspectives because it's an inherently irrational act. And yet it is something that human beings have done and are doing. And so to understand that, you need to understand those complexities. And I think the multiple entry points and frankly, the multiple levels of experience for the people participating, be it a singer in our children's choir from the Cedar Valley Children's Choir, a singer from Wartburg, a singer from the Met Chorale. I mean, they're going to bring different flavors and tastes and understandings to this. And we hope that's the experience of the audience, too. Everyone has a different level of background knowledge to the Holocaust in general, but Kristallnacht in particular. And as they bring those perspectives together, we sort of find some sort of shared truth in it. But it takes all those perspectives in order to reach people. This is not something that you and I want to sit around over a cup of coffee and chat about. It's difficult thinking. It's difficult to accept as a human being. And those multiple perspectives that shared, again, the wonderful metaphor of music, which has that ability to bypass the rational and speak directly to the heart, that's a great format for dealing with these complex things.
Stephen Gaze talks about the role of the four UNI theater students.
There are hundreds of eyewitness accounts, because obviously this event touched hundreds of thousands of people. And from immediately after Kristallnacht, right up to the present, people who lived through that night have told their stories. We wanted to find stories of Kristallnacht survivors who have settled in the Midwest. We thought that would make a closer connection between these events that took place in Europe decades and decades ago. And so we've chosen four eyewitness accounts from people who were as young as five up to adolescence. And students in the UNI Department of Theater are going to convert those accounts into dramatic portrayals so that they'll be speaking as if they're talking about an event that has recently happened or that happened only a few years ago rather than back in their childhood. And I think it's going to be very, very powerful. I think that the words, because they tell personal stories, are going to complement the power of music, and I think they're going to add a great deal to the afternoon.
Let's talk about some things that will be happening on this concert and what's going to be performed and who's performing it.
Well, I'll mention quickly that the symphony is involved. There's just no way we could mount a program like this by ourselves. And I think in a way that would sort of be against the purpose of the whole idea of this event, to do something like this by yourself. This program, I think, in a lot of ways called for a community approach. And so for us, this is, you know, not the first collaboration we've done or the only one, but it's one of the bigger, more meaningful collaborations. And so the orchestra will be featured sort of in one of the central pieces, a work by Shostakovich, the Chamber Symphony, which is actually an arrangement of his 8th string quartet. And this is Shostakovich's very personal response to the events of the Holocaust and is one of the ways in which we see a composer responding from a particular distance to these events. So Shostakovich had the opportunity to actually go to some of these camps and reflect on his own experience as not really a political prisoner, but in a way, very much a political prisoner of the mind and in actuality probably a bit too with his experience with Stalin. And so to see an individual like that very close to the source of all this, but not having gone through it himself, instead reflecting on it, that's one perspective. And we have other perspectives that come out on the program as well.
Jason continues talking about works to be performed and musicians performing in their Kristallnacht program.
There's a whole host of wonderful musicians involved in this. First and foremost among them is Hunter Cappuccioni. What folks may not know about Hunter, aside from the fact that he's a director and founder of Cedar Valley Chamber Music and a great bass player, is that he's also done some very interesting work connected with the Holocaust. Even though it's not really an intrinsic part of his personal story, artistically it's something that he's been involved with over the years. So Hunter is actually going to perform a solo piece, which he found and has performed before in settings that deal with this kind of subject matter. And also because of that connection, we're going to involve a few Cedar Valley Chamber Music musicians to play alongside musicians from the symphony. And I'll also kind of do a couple different things on this program, and one of them will be to play clarinet. We're going to do a work together called The Overture on Hebrew Themes by Sergei Prokofiev, which is a really interesting work and is an interesting piece to consider. Where was Prokofiev coming from and what does this piece signify? But if you step back from it as well, it's a really kind of haunting piece. It's almost like looking at a picture of the before, you know, this all these events. It's like an old snapshot of what it used to be like. And so it provides an interesting bit of nostalgia and it sort of sets a little bit of context for some of the works that surround it. So with those other folks involved, I think the center of the program has some really interesting moments and very interesting progression. And those are just the instrumentalists involved. The Met Chorale is involved. We also have quite an extensive Cedar Valley Children's Choir with kids from Waterloo as well as from Waverly. So kids from the Wartburg choirs under Lee Nelson are going to join us as well, and a couple guest artists. So it's a pretty enormous range of musicians who are going to be part of this. But I think that's all the more to the point of what we're doing, and I think it will really enhance the effect of the performance.
And this Paulus piece was specifically written to bring a lot of different things forward.
Yeah, this work was actually created up in the Twin Cities as an interfaith partnership. Two religious leaders, one Jewish and one Catholic, I believe, got together and sort of conceived this commission. And Stephen Paulus, who's also based in the Twin Cities, he was commissioned to write this work. So again, even in the genesis of the sort of central bookend work on the program, there's this idea that this theme ought to be something that we approach with a little more universality and a little wider point of view rather than a very narrow point of view. And I think that's been so important to us from the beginning of the project. The other thing I should say about that work is that Lee Nelson, who directs the Metropolitan Chorale as well as the choirs up at Wartburg, he has been quite instrumental in the life of this piece. It was premiered by the Minnesota Orchestra, But subsequently, I think really most of the performances that have occurred have been directed by Lee Nelson. He's done it several different times, and he's also taken some excerpts from this piece on college choir tours. So Lee is, in a way, the perfect person also to have involved in this artistic group because of his familiarity with his work and because of his tremendous advocacy for this piece, not just around here in Iowa, but, you know, taking it on tour around the world. So we kind of have a dream team, I guess, in that sense, when we look at the artists who are involved.
Jason Weinberger, along with UNI's Stephen Gaze and UNI's Steve Carignan. The Kristallnacht, Night of Broken Glass program, will be held at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center on Sunday, November 10th at 3 p.m. Some of the over 300 musicians include the Metropolitan Chorale, the Wartburg Choir, the Cedar Valley Honor Chorus, Brian Falsgraf, the Cedar Valley Chamber Music Ensemble, Hunter Cappuccioni, Lee Nelson, Jason Weinberger, and members of the WCF Symphony. For more information about the Kristallnacht performance and tickets, please see gbpac.com or wcfsymphony.org. Iowa Public Radio Classicals Performance Iowa will also be presenting a live broadcast of this powerful program. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this production goes to Jeffrey Bullock, Thomas Robbins, Kim Finley, Michael Gilbertson, Steve Carignan, Stephen Gaze, and Jason Weinberger. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Thanks for this show also goes to Iowa Public Radio's Al Scherz, Eric Jordan, Jason Burns, Garrett Van Leeuwen, and Cooper Holmeyer. Program research was provided by IPR's Nick Carlo and Mallory Sullivan. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.